and the organisers of the Rabat Statistics meeting as well. So I've been asked to give an educational, in inverted commas, lecture on Brasskamp-Lieb inequality and its relationship to geometry, which I know a lot of people have seen. This is not particularly new stuff. Maybe I'll find just a couple of remarks for people who have seen it, but not very many, I have to confess. But if you haven't, then it's aimed at you. This talk is aimed at you. So what is the topic, this inequality of Brasskamp and Lieb? So the inequality and a reverse version of it, which was proved by Franck Barthes about 6 years ago, are rather precise inequalities for norms of convolutions. And the point, the reason they're being talked about here, is that they have applications to geometry, which are somewhat surprising, at least when you first see them. The basic inequality for convolutions on locally compact groups is Young's inequality. So you have a pair of functions, f and g, on a locally compact group, and they belong to appropriate LP spaces with respect to the Haar measure on the group. And there's a relationship between the spaces to which they belong and an index S. And then the inequality says that the S norm of the convolution is controlled by the product of the appropriate norms of the functions. So the way to think of this is that when you convolve, you improve the LP smoothness of the function. So if you think of G as a fixed function and F as varying, then when you convolve F with G, you improve the smoothness. F star G is somehow more smooth than F. And there is a constant, there is an implied constant, obviously 1 here, and on compact groups, the inequality is sharp because constant functions belong to LP spaces, they're integrable. So you can't in general improve the constant, but on the real line, which is actually the most important case naturally, you can improve the constant. The inequality is not sharp as it's written. So something dramatic happens. As soon as constant functions are eliminated, something really changes. And during the 70s, there was a lot of work on inequalities of this kind, inequalities in harmonic analysis, and in finding the best constants in such inequalities. And Bechner played a crucial role in understanding the norm of the Fourier transform between LP spaces, the so-called Hausdorff-Young inequality. And then he and Brasskamp and Lieb independently showed that the correct constant in Young's inequality is attained if F and G are particular Gaussian densities. So they have this form where A and B depend upon P and Q in a way which is rather unpleasant. I mean, we'll see that this is something in geometry we can avoid, and that's nice because the dependence is pretty unpleasant, and the actual constant that goes there is also rather unpleasant. Right, well, in order to explain not only the result of Brasskamp and Lieb, but also the connection with geometry, I want to reformulate things a little bit. So I'm going to rewrite Young's inequality initially just using duality. So S was the norm of the convolution, the LP norm that the convolution was supposed to be controlled in. And I can realize that by hitting F star G with a function in the appropriate LR space. And P, Q, and R are now rather symmetrically defined. Their reciprocals add up to 2. And so the original inequality, Young's inequality, can be rewritten this way. So in here I've got the integral with respect to y, which gives me the convolution, and the integral against x, which gives me the norm. And I'm just saying that this is controlled by the product of the norm. So it's now nice and symmetric. So if you like, this is the value at 0 of a convolution of 3 functions, but I'm going to think of it as being something a little bit different in a minute. And for reasons, technical reasons that will perhaps become apparent but are not terribly important, I'd like to write the h of x as h of minus x. Since h is just any old function, of course, it makes no difference. And so I can write the inequality this way. So this is a reformulation of Young's inequality, which has the advantage of being symmetric with respect to the indices. And that was, of course, why I called SS, so that R was R, right? PQR next to it. Right. Okay. Now, what did Brascamp and Leib then actually prove? So it's now possible to show why their inequality generalizes as well as sharpens Young's inequality. So the integral that was on the previous page was this one here. And I can write it in the following way, where x is now a variable in two-dimensional space, and the expressions y, x minus y, and minus x are the inner products of x with particular vectors, which I've written down, the obvious vectors. And I wrote it big. I was told to write it big. I thought this was quite big.
No, it's okay. It's mighty.
Ah, okay. So what does Brascamp-Leib say? It says that if we now have not three vectors but m vectors, and not in the plane but in Rn, and we have m functions on the line, and we have exponents pi, which satisfy a reciprocal type relation where we replace 2 by n, then this ratio, the ratio of the integral of the product to the product of the LP norms, is maximized by appropriate Gaussian densities. And I put maximized in inverted commas because of the remark underneath that the maximum isn't always attained. There are degenerate cases. And in a moment we'll see that, again, from the point of view of geometry, that's something we scrub out. We get rid of all that. Now, obviously this is a sharpening in the sense that we've got the correct constant, at least implicitly, because we've said what the maximizers are, their Gaussian densities, although obviously there's still an issue of computing what the constant actually is by looking at various different Gaussian densities. But more importantly, from the geometric point of view, this is also a generalization, because m and n are not 3 and 2, but most importantly, m and n may differ by more than 1. So that the 3-2 case could be extended automatically to the case in which m is n plus 1, but here the crucial point is that m needn't be just 1 more than n. So Young's inequality, the original Young's inequality with the sharp constant, is the case when m is n plus 1. But the general case is genuinely more general, the case in which the number of vectors is allowed to be large. And I've put a rather vague statement there that multiple convolution operators are studied a good deal in harmonic analysis. So multiple convolution, of course, here means, in a sense, that we're not just convolving in the ordinary way. But I'll explain a little bit more in just a moment what I mean by this. However, within the context of harmonic analysis, where constants are not usually crucial, the estimates you need for these kinds of convolution operators do follow from earlier results, rearrangement type inequalities of the same sort of names attached, Brascamp-Leib and also Luttinger. The sharp constant was not for the purposes of harmonic analysis. It was more, I think, for the purposes of understanding what was going on, really, rather than harmonic analysis. Okay, now, as I said, I'm going to explain a little more about that, but before I do, I want to suggest how the geometry comes in. So I want to return to the Young inequality that I wrote down, the original Young inequality, or the slightly modified Young inequality with this H. And this time, instead of rewriting it using these inner products with vectors, I'll map the whole thing into, in this case, three-dimensional space, the dimension corresponding to the number of functions, by just rewriting this vector y, x minus y, minus x as u, v, w. And then the reason that I put the minus x is so that those numbers would add up to zero, because, again, this keeps a nice symmetric-looking range. The description of the range in these coordinates is nice and symmetric. And so, apart from the fact that there is a Jacobian for this particular map, we can rewrite this integral as the integral of a product. Product meaning a function going in each coordinate direction, so a special kind of product, with respect to the two-dimensional measure on the subspace H. And already this begins to look a little bit more geometric, since we're now really looking at subspaces and things rather than just analytic expressions. What Young's inequality therefore does is estimate the integral over a subspace of a special kind of function, namely one of these functions, which is a product of things on functions of the separate variables. Okay, now, there is a rather simple product function that we're familiar with. Namely, if we take each of the functions to be the characteristic function of an interval, then their product in this sense is simply the characteristic function of a cube. And so what we're doing here is we're taking the characteristic function of a cube, and then we're integrating it over a certain subspace. In this case, it's the subspace consisting of points whose coordinates add up to zero. So assuming that the front of my cube is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, etc., then I'm integrating it over a subspace whose intersection with the cube is this hexagon. In other words, I'm calculating the area of a slice of a cube. And this is the point, as far as geometry is concerned. All the applications to geometry essentially depend upon this, namely that we're integrating a slice of a body. We're calculating the volume or the area of a slice of a body. And any polytope can be realized as the slice of a cube, any symmetric polytope. And then when we move to non-symmetric convex sets, there is a trick for putting things into the same pattern, the same picture. So I've written that down here. The integral of F over a subspace is the area of a slice of a cube. And in principle, we can get any convex body we want, essentially in this way. Right, now, perhaps I'll leave that one there and expand on the remark I made before, as I said I would. So, within harmonic analysis, quite a lot of what happens involves integrating over something lower dimensional. So there's been quite a lot of work in the last few years in harmonic analysis on estimating convolution operators with respect to certain curved sets. So, for example, a simple case, we take a circle C, and then we have a function, let's say on the plane, which is the average around translated circle, dy, I should really put d, measure on the circle, of course. So we average a function on the plane around circles to get a new function. And when we do that, what happens is that the Q norm of G is controlled by the P norm of F, where Q is bigger than P. In other words, this averaging produces some kind of smoothing, local smoothing. If you belong to an LP space with a larger value of P, it means that locally you're better behaved. Okay, so averaging over lower dimensional things can yield you an object, a function, which is better behaved locally. Now, the same thing is happening in the case of Brascamp-Lieb. You're averaging or integrating over lower dimensional things, subspaces, and the convolution you get belongs to a better LP space. I said you get this LP smoothing. Now, in the case that I'm describing here, we need that C has curvature, that it doesn't have any flat pieces. And the reason, of course, is that if you take any old function, and if you're allowed to take any old function, and just integrating it along, let's say, lines like this, then, of course, if the function has the property that it's a product in the direction of these lines in the perpendicular direction, then obviously you don't get any smoothing because you just get the same function back in the direction that's left. And so, obviously, the situation in Brascamp-Lieb is slightly strange. The difference, of course, is that we have products. Here we have products over flat things. In other words, it's a special kind of function. You're not allowed to have the function cooked up so as not to capture the directions of the slices on which you're integrating. The point is that the slice is not parallel to the directions in which the product is is defined. And so even though the thing you're integrating over is flat, you don't get this kind of situation occurring. You do get improvements. Okay, so this is how the thing fits, as it were, into a more general picture in harmonic analysis. But it is different from this sort of example because we rely on properties of the functions, not of the shape that we're averaging over. That's perhaps the best way of putting it. Okay. So I think I can move on. Now, what about the applications to geometry? What applications do we have? These originally came about because of a question asked by Rogalski on volume ratios. So I know this is also old hat, but I want to at least have this somewhere during the lecture. So Fritz John's theorem tells us that each convex body contains an ellipsoid of largest volume, and much more importantly, it describes what this thing looks like, characterizes this ellipsoid, and the characterization is best written in the situation where you have transformed, so that the maximal ellipsoid is the standard Euclidean ball, center 0, radius 1. And it says that this is the situation if there are lots of contact points, so lots of places where the ball touches the boundary of the body, and lots has a geometric meaning. And so the crucial point here is that the lots of places has a geometric meaning. Their average with respect to a certain system of weights is zero, the center of the ball, and the inertia tensor of the distribution is the identity. So I've simply restated that there. Now, we often write the inertia tensor condition, well, in tensor notation, not surprisingly, and the only thing I want to point out here is that this U tensor U is an orthogonal projection. We'll see in a minute that generalization in higher dimensions, we work with orthogonal projections rather than with particular decompositions of the identity in terms of vectors. So actually it turns out that the right way to think of these really is as orthogonal projections, but they're rank one orthogonal projections, so we can write them like this if we want to. When we equate traces of these operators, we get that the weights that we've chosen, the positive weights Ci, add up to n. Again, that will be important in just a second. Right. And the next slide does quickly tell you what volume ratio is, if you didn't know. It's the ratio of the volumes of the body and the ellipsoid that we just found. Normally, we take the nth root, but for my purposes, since all the inequalities are precise, it really doesn't matter. I mean, it's only when you're interested in inequalities with constants that you take the nth root so that you don't have to take constant to the power n. But for me, of course, this doesn't matter. Right, let's get back to Brasskamp-Lieb. So Brasskamp-Lieb says that this ratio is maximized by appropriate Gaussian densities. Here they are. Fi of t is e to the minus ai t squared. Now, as Brasskamp and Lieb pointed out in their article, there is a problem with this, namely that actually computing the correct AIs from the vectors VI and the exponents PI is not very easy. The AIs are solutions of nonlinear equations, which you can't in general solve. I mean, you cannot actually just write down the solution. And in their paper, they gave a proof that a certain system of equations did give the correct AIs. And naturally, from their point of view, since they were coming from the harmonic analysis point of view, what was given was the VIs and the PIs, and their aim was to find the AIs in order to compute the best constant. But it turns out that from the geometric point of view, this is actually really completely the wrong way of looking at things. That in the context of Fritz John's theorem, it turns out that what is given to you is not the P's and the V's, actually, but it's the A's that are given to you rather strangely, and then you somehow cook up the P's and the V's. And within this context, it turns out that we can get rid of all the problems that arise with that come from computing the constants, and also at the same time, we avoid the degenerate cases and various other things which are not so nice. So, how does it work? Here we are. So this is the normalized form of the inequality. So we simply give ourselves a collection of unit vectors which satisfy the Fritz-John condition, or the second part of the Fritz-John condition, the inertia tensor condition. And we have functions defined on the line, Fi. And then the powers, the exponents we take, will be the reciprocals of these very Ci's that appear in the Fritz-John decomposition. So what's happening is that these Ci's are playing the roles of the reciprocals of the PIs, and because of the trace condition in arising from this identity, the CIs add up to the right thing, and therefore we have the correct homogeneity for the inequality that we needed in the first place. The sharp constant now is 1. This Fritz-John condition guarantees that the constant is 1, and that, of course, makes the thing much easier to use, obviously, apart from anything else. Because we don't have to worry about computing the constant. And the reason that the constant turns out nice is that something even nicer is happening. Namely, what I've done, you see, here, in a sense, is replace the original functions by functions to the power pi. So this should have been an LP norm here. So there should be, you would think, a 1 over ci here. But there isn't. I've just changed the functions. And doing that ensures that the set of Gaussians that produces the extremal case are all the same. All the Gaussians that appear in that set are the same. So we said before that some collection of Gaussians is extremal. Here, in this form, we know which collection, namely the ones which are all the same. So from a geometric point of view, this is a much clearer way of understanding the inequality. And I'd just like to point out why extremal Gaussian densities give constant 1, why identical Gaussian densities give constant 1. So this is not a proof of the inequality, this is just a proof that if 1 is a bound, it is the best bound you can have because of identical Gaussians. So the point is that if we rewrite the Fritz-John condition this way, as a resolution of the sum of the squares of the entries of a vector, and then we take identical densities, this product here under the integral translates immediately into e to the minus length of x squared from here, and then we can split it up a different way, namely according to the coordinates, calculate it according to the coordinates, and then recover this formulation because we know exactly the integral of the Fi's along the line. So the point is that Gaussians fit with the Fritz-John condition precisely because they have a t-squared in the exponent. That's the crucial thing here. And that, of course, was the whole point of the reformulation. That's where it came from in the first place. Right, now, next week, for those of you who are still here, so I'll tantalise those who aren't, Franck is going to give a talk which I believe will include... You're not... All right, we'll wait and see. Anyway... the fact remains that he found a new proof of Brasskamp-Lieb and a reverse version, which I conjectured. And his proof is a great deal simpler and clearer, and also works very well and turns out to have very interesting connections with the topic of next week's conference, which is transportation. When you move to higher dimensions, I'll describe that in a second. And the reverse form of the inequality says this. You have the same Fritz-John condition, you have measurable functions on the line, and then you have another function which dominates them in an appropriate sense, namely that whenever you represent x in an appropriate way in terms of the UIs, then f of x is bigger than the product of a certain combination of the Fi's. And many of you will be familiar with the fact that this looks like a Prekopa-Leindler, a functional version of the Brum-Minkowski inequality. And when I move to higher dimensions, I will point out that, in fact, this reverse inequality really does generalize Brum-Minkowski. And this time the inequality goes the other way. Obviously, we're saying F is big, capital F is big. So we have an inequality the other direction. one small remark that because of the Fritz-John condition, we can always represent a vector x in this particular way. In other words, we can always choose the theta i's here to be the inner products, in which case, of course, the expression you get here was precisely the thing that turned up in the Brasskamp-Lieb inequality on the left. So, in other words, what is obvious from the Fritz-John condition is that the integral of capital F is bigger than the thing that would go on the other side if we were looking at the original Brasskamp-Lieb inequality. Obviously, the problem is to fit the thing in the middle. That's the difficulty. What is obvious is that the left, this is bigger than that. Okay. Now, I've advertised the higher dimensional versions, so I'll tell you what those are. The higher dimensional version, of Brasskamp-Lieb was proved by Lieb just in time, not to have it proved by Franck. But there it is. It involves, now, as I said, orthogonal projections, which resolve the identity in this apparently rather simpler-looking way than the rank one. So, indeed, the whole picture looks a little bit clearer, actually, in this formulation. We have a representation of the identity in terms of orthogonal projections, and then for each projection we have a function on the range of Pi. We somehow identify a function on a lower dimensional space with a function on the range of Pi so that we can give obvious meanings to these two different sides, and then the inequality looks just the same, and this condition guarantees that the homogeneity works out right, everything is fine. And the reverse version, maybe I can fit them both on here, actually. Now, again, we have a slightly simpler-looking expression. We just represent x in some way using things which belong to the appropriate spaces, but with the weight ci. Obviously, the ci's always have to appear. And it is this inequality which generalizes Brunn-Minkowski. And it does so in the simplest possible case. So even the simplest possible case of this inequality is already Brunn-Minkowski. Namely, when the PIs are just the identity. So obviously you can resolve the identity as a combination of identities. And then all you're saying is that if you have, so you've got the identity resolved as 1 minus lambda times the identity plus lambda times the identity, and f would be the indicator function of a body, g will be the indicator function of another body, and the condition here says that if you can represent a point as 1 minus lambda times a plus lambda times b, where a and b are in the space, that's the only condition, then what we know is that f of x is at least, f of a to the 1 minus lambda, g of b to the lambda. So in other words, what this means is that we can take f to be the characteristic function of the Minkowski combination. That's all that this inequality says. And so the integral then says, the inequality then says that the volume of the Minkowski combination is at least the volume of A to the 1 minus lambda, volume of B to the lambda. So we get the Brunn-Minkowski inequality just from the trivial resolution of the identity as a combination of itself twice. Right. There are two here. I think perhaps I'll leave that slide and move on to the applications, since that was one of the things I was actually asked to do. So, as I said, the original application which prompted the reformulation was to volume ratios, and the result here is that among convex bodies, the simplex has the largest volume ratio exactly, and among symmetric bodies, the cube has the largest. And I'm going to prove the cube case using Brasskamp-Lieb. The simplex case is a little more complicated. In particular, because you have to move into a higher dimensional space in order to take account of the other condition in Fritz-John's theorem. So remember, Brasskamp-Lieb handles the condition on the tensors, on the inertia tensor, but the average condition, which says that the center of mass is at the origin, you need something, you need to bring that in a different way. But the cube case is nice and simple. So we've got B2N as the ellipsoid of maximal volume. And then if you look at this picture, but imagine for a moment that the original body was actually this, which obviously has the same ellipsoid of maximal volume since it has the same contact points. You can nevertheless pretend that the body is actually just given by the contact points, because the thing you're interested in sits inside a larger body whose boundary functionals are just these particular contact points. So we may as well assume that K or C itself is actually this set here, and we want to control the volume of this set. Actually, this is a symmetric case, so that wasn't a very good picture, but you get the idea. Okay. And then we just choose for our FIs, the FIs to which we're going to apply Brasskamp-Lieb, the indicator functions of the interval, or the indicator function of the interval over and over again. And then the indicator function of this larger K is just this product. The CIs here play no role. 1 to the 1 is 1. The CIs, of course, come in on the other side. The volume of K is the integral on the left. This product here is the product of 2 to the CI, which is 2 to the N. And that, of course, is the volume of the cube, whose ellipsoid of maximal volume is the standard Euclidean ball. So it's very, very simple. It's straight from the normalized form of Brasskamp-Lieb. And from that followed a reverse isoperimetric inequality. The isoperimetric inequality, which follows from Brum-Minkowski, says that among bodies of a given volume, the Euclidean balls have least surface area. Obviously, if you want to reverse it, you have to be a little careful how you state it. So, but it's fairly natural to restrict attention to convex bodies and then to allow yourself an affine image, so to look at equivalence classes, affine equivalence classes of convex bodies. And once you do that, then the one with bigger surface area is the simplex, and among centrally symmetric things, it's the cube. So the situation here is that roughly speaking, we have the isoperimetric inequality, which really is sort of the same as the Brun-Minkowski inequality, and then we have the reverse isoperimetric inequality, which is sort of the same as Brasskamp-Lieb, and this is sort of the same as the reverse form, which is Barth's inequality. Of course, when I mean the same, I mean these are obviously, they get harder as you go down the board, but they are kind of symmetric across the board. Okay, so these are inequalities in the same direction, but obviously becoming more complicated, and similarly these are inequalities in the same direction. So this is the sort of the picture to have of how these fit together. So this is the statement. The proof of it is very simple once you have the volume ratio estimate, in either case, both the cube and the simplex. The difficulty in the simplex is to get the volume ratio estimate, as well as, obviously, Brasskamp-Lieb. This deduction from the volume ratio estimate is identical in the two cases. It's very simple. I'll quickly explain that, although most people will have seen it. So, of course, if you want to find an affine image which gives you nice small surface area, there is an optimal one. There is one which has the smaller surface area for a given volume, but that's not the one that we use to prove the theorem because it's just a bit too complicated to use. In the extreme cases, of course, it will be the same as the one that we use to prove the theorem, otherwise we wouldn't get the right result. But in general, what we do is pick a different representation, namely the volume ratio position or the volume ratio affine image, and that's good enough in all cases to prove the inequality that we want. And in the case of the cube, so I'll do it just in the case of the cube, as I say, there's no real difference between the two cases here. The inequality we want controls the volume of the, or the area, the surface area, by the appropriate power of the volume, and the constant for the cube is 2n. And what we're told is that if we put the body in a position where its Euclidean ball, its maximal ellipsoid is the standard Euclidean ball, then its volume is at most 2 to the n, the volume of the cube. That's the volume ratio estimate. And that's enough to give what we want. So we write the surface area as the derivative of volume, and then we use in two different places the fact that the Euclidean ball is inside C and the fact that it's maximal. So the fact that it's inside C means we can control the surface area by replacing B2N here by a copy of C itself and just turn this into a multiple of the volume of C. We split it up so that we get the appropriate appropriate homogeneity of the power here, and then we use the fact that B2N is the maximal ellipsoid to control the extra constant volume to the 1 over N, which gives us the 2 that we want. So again, this is very simple, and the argument for the simplex is really the same. Now, the things that I haven't ever talked about, and which are not so different, but they may be a little different, are going to start now. So the reverse form of the Brascamp-Lieb inequality that was proved by Franck, not surprisingly, handles the outer volume ratio. So in other words, if you have a convex body, then there is a minimal ellipsoid which contains it, a minimal volume ellipsoid which contains it, and you can look at the ratio of the volumes, and you would hope that the largest ratio occurs for the L1 ball of the appropriate dimension. But this doesn't follow from what we did just by duality. There's no way that you can deduce this just by duality. You need a separate inequality, at least within the current state of knowledge, to prove this. What do we need to know? That the volume of the L1 ball is 2 to the n over n factorial. And then how do we proceed? We write the volume of the body itself as an integral of a function of the norm, the negative exponential of the norm. Polar coordinates will tell you immediately that this is that these are equal. The norm can be written this way. Whenever you represent, if you represent x this way, then the norm will be at most the sum of the lambdas, because the u's we know are contact points, and so they're vectors of norm 1. And this is precisely set up for us to apply Barthes reverse inequality, where this time, for our functions, instead of indicator functions, we take, as it were, the dual functions, namely negative exponentials. So instead of L-infinity type things, we take L1 type things. So we apply the inequality with e to the minus mod t, and we get precisely this, which tells us that the volume, since that's 1 over n factorial times this integral, is at least the volume of the L1 ball. So in other words, what I've done is I've said we have a body like this, which touches in various places. We've used these places to build the norm, and then we've said that the volume of the body is nice and large. That's exactly saying that the outer volume ratio is no worse than for the L1 ball. So again, Barthes inequality is exactly set up in the right way to give precisely this kind of result. Now, Franck actually used it to prove a harder result concerning mean width when he first proved it, but I think that for an educational talk, this is a slightly easier way to understand why the inequality should look the way it does if it's going to have an application to geometry. Right. The Fritz John's theorem was generalized by Lewis, and once you've generalized it, you can then, as it were, go back and think of John's theorem as the L-infinity case, whereas Lewis's is the LP case. Obviously, the way John's theorem is stated, it doesn't really look as though it's got much to do with L-infinity, but once you've generalized it, you see that it does. And the generalization says that if you have an n-dimensional subspace of an LP space, let's say LPM, then we can represent it on Rn with, in other words, we can find an affine or linear transformation, once we've put it on Rn, a position on Rn, so that the norm is represented in this way. And the point here, of course, is that, well, obviously this is an LP norm, that's not a problem. The point here is that the same CIs give you a representation of the norm, the LP subspace norm, and the standard Euclidean norm on the space. So in other words, you find a way of representing it on the space so that the same weights give you both the norm and the Euclidean norm simultaneously, as it were. Now, in the L-infinity case, I'm not sure I actually said P is less than infinity in this case. In the L-infinity case, this, of course, would read something like this. And, of course, the Fritz-Jong condition, which is the same. And this is false. What happens when you pass from LP to L infinity, when you go up to L infinity, is that this equality here shatters into an inequality. The point is, if you look at the maximum volume ellipsoid, you remember that you have situations like the one there. So that, since this is symmetric, I suppose I should, should draw a symmetric one. You have situations like the one there, in which the contact points control the body, but they don't give you exactly the shape of the body. And there's no way that you can pick up exactly the shape of the body using a volume ratio thing. So it's worth pointing out that Lewis's generalization, in a sense, is not a generalization in a way, but obviously that's how it came about, because you don't get an inequality there. You don't get an identity there. You get an inequality, whichever way the body is small, so the norm is big. But, of course, once you have Lewis's lemma, then you recognize that you're going to be able to apply Brasskamp and Lieb. It's set up in order to apply the inequality with the appropriate functions. So instead of indicator functions, you apply e... Whoops. That's not going to be very integrable. E to the minus t to the p. And the conclusion is that, again, volume ratios, when you're looking at subspaces of LP, the worst subspace is the natural one, the ordinary little LP of the appropriate dimension. And the P equals 1 case was proved earlier, following from a much more general result on volume ratios of subspaces with spaces with co-type 2, which was proved by Bourgain and Milman. And I thought that ending on the name of an organizer would be a good way to finish the lecture.
Yeah. Once came by an old paper, I don't remember the author, where it proved in dimension 2 the inverse isoperimetric.
Yeah, is it Berend?
I don't remember the name of the author.
Yeah.
There he took the position where the maximal ellipsoid is the ball, but the maximal, a maximal triangle, a volume triangle,
yeah,
is regular.
Yeah.
Ever try to do it in higher dimension with a maximal volume simplex?
Are you crazy?
would it give the same? I don't know. Would it be a position where a body gets a better isoperimetric quotient than the simplex?
Probably. But come on, we have no machinery for tackling this at all. I mean, there's no way. You know, once you go into three dimensions, you can't do anything. So there's no chance. But you know, by all means, spend the rest of your life working on it.
Any other question? Holman? If not, thanks again.